This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Saul Gonzalez from KQED's The California Report, sitting in for Steve Chiatakis. Fighting COVID-19 isn't easy anywhere in the world, but if you're a tourism-dependent chain of islands in the middle of the Pacific, like Hawaii, it creates particular challenges. When the pandemic first started, travel to Hawaii plummeted. The state put in strict quarantine rules for visitors, and the islands were largely spared from the worst of the virus. Now, things have changed.
With the economy back open, tourism in full swing over the summer, a spike in cases did seem inevitable. We just didn't know it'd be this bad.
That's Nate Jones, who was born and raised on the island of Oahu and now lives in L.A. He's among a large group of Hawaiian Angelenos, the largest group of Hawaiians outside of Hawaii, in fact, who don't want you to visit the islands right now. The Aloha State is experiencing its highest number of COVID cases, hospitalizations, and deaths since the pandemic started. Even Hawaii's Governor David Ige is telling you to stay home.
It is a risky time to be traveling right now. I did ask everyone, residents and visitors alike, to reduce travel to Hawaii to essential business activities only. It's not a good time to travel to the islands.
Here to talk about COVID in Hawaii and how it's affecting the sizable Hawaiian population that lives in the LA area are native Hawaiian and LA resident Aaron Lau, who's a filmmaker, and Casey Harlow, a reporter with Hawaii Public Radio, who joins us from Honolulu. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
So, Casey, let's start with you there in Hawaii. I understand health officials in the state just reported 13 new COVID deaths. That's the highest one-day fatality figure since the pandemic started. Healthcare workers are also reporting a shortage of oxygen supply. How serious is the situation there right now, and what new precautions are being taken?
Cases have been at an all-time high ever since the pandemic has started. In the last 2 weeks, we have seen nearly 11,000 new cases. Positivity rate for all tests is around 8%. So we are definitely seeing a surge in the spread of the Delta variant. And right now, as you heard, Governor David Ige encouraged visitors not to visit at this time because our hospitals are getting to a point of being overwhelmed, and we have a hospital system that has declared an internal state of emergency, and the city and county of Honolulu is actually assisting wherever they can. And we are starting to see now that trailers are being brought in to help with the morgues. But as far as restrictions go on Oahu, starting on September 13th, going to have a proof of vaccination for restaurants, bars, gyms, and other businesses.
And Aaron, let's turn to you. Again, you're a native Hawaiian who now lives in Los Angeles. How has the pandemic affected your Hawaiian friends and family, both there in Hawaii and here in Southern California?
Yeah, I'll start with my friends and family back there. I mean, the biggest thing that just stood out to me is that the things I do know is every single week I am seeing social media posts or receiving phone calls, text messages about a new childhood friend, neighbor, classmate, family member that knows someone who's sick, who is having difficulty getting a room in a hospital because of something not even related to COVID. And so unlike last year, I feel it closing in more and more. And it causes a lot of anxiety for a lot of us up here. I was afraid to go back most of last year because I couldn't live with myself if I was the reason my family or friends got sick. And the only when I did finally go back, it was because of a personal emergency. And I think I spent most of that time trying to warn people of like some sort of apocalypse in the future that was coming after spending so much time in LA during our peak. But it's just become so apparent for myself and a lot of my friends that a lot of people we care about are getting sick or feeling the burden of it. The pressure is really starting to build.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll ask this of each of you, but Casey, I'll start with you there in Honolulu. What about the impact of the pandemic on Native Hawaiians in particular versus the rest of the population there? Of course, Hawaii, I think probably the most multicultural population in the United States. But when it comes to Native Hawaiians, who are about, what, 20, 21% of the population, how is it affecting them?
It is impacting Native Hawaiians a lot more than other minorities. And that could also be due to, you know, the communities that they live in. Native Hawaiians generally live in areas that don't have a lot of resources or are in communities that are a little bit on the more rural side of the islands and not having a lot of access. There is a huge push with the hospitals and healthcare system to have clinics and have mobile vaccination clinics go out to them to provide shots. But there is definitely an impact on the Native Hawaiian community here.
And Aaron, do you have anything to add to that? And also, in addition, I've been reading a lot about, you know, increasing vaccination hesitancy within the Native Hawaiian population. Is that something you've heard about from your own family and friends?
Yeah, it's, for me, it's one of the most complicated but understandable parts of this. It's like I understand the hesitancy given our history with the U.S. government and the overthrow of our government and years of just mistreatment and racism. Hawaiians have lost thousands of our ancestors and our family members over generations due to smallpox or measles or tuberculosis. And we can't afford to keep having our community lose so many loved ones and lose just so many lives. And it's, I don't know, I really think a lot of the solution starts in our homes and having what is often very difficult conversations with our loved ones. But I understand you, and I share a lot of the distrust and suspicion just because of our history. But we need you, and there's a lot of facts and a lot of information backing this, and we don't want to lose you.
Sure, sure. And Casey, I return to you there in Honolulu. What do you think happens next? And what do you think is going to happen with, you know, Hawaii society and the economy in light of these messages from people to sort of stay away from the islands for a while?
We are basically waiting to see what happens next. I think the latest report that we've gotten as far as the ICU beds and available beds at hospitals, we are getting very close to that 500 target that our lieutenant governor often cites here, basically like his benchmark of when the system is going to be way overwhelmed. But as far as tourism, we are entering our shoulder season, traditionally a shoulder season for tourism, which means that there's a little bit less visitors that are coming, and government officials are trying as much as they can to have certain restrictions in place without going to a complete lockdown again, because we've seen the devastation that it's had on local businesses and the economy here as far as keeping things closed.
Yeah. And Aaron, just finally to you, and to underscore a point I think you made earlier as well, what do you say to someone who has their plane reservations to Honolulu, they have their hotel booked, they're ready to go? What would be your advice to them? And what would you be your advice to your fellow Native Hawaiians who are homesick and want to go back?
I'll put it this way. I can't necessarily make folks who don't know me or my family or my community care about me or my feelings. But with where our resources are right now and the burden being put on our medical facilities, no matter how careful you are, there's so many things outside of our control. And if you get hurt or someone you care about gets hurt, we can't promise that they'll get what the support they need. And so I just ask, for at the very least, your own health and your loved one's health, please just play it safe. Consider a trip to the woods. I've done it. It's lovely. There are other places we can go, because I understand after this last year, we all need a little space, but I just can't, it's not good for us right now back home.
Yeah. All right. We have been talking to Hawaii Public Radio's Casey Harlow and native Hawaiian filmmaker and LA resident Aaron Lau. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA. I'm Saul Gonzalez, sitting in for Steve Chiatakis this week. When you think about innovative California industries, I bet Hollywood and Silicon Valley come immediately to mind. But you should add to that list dining and affordable restaurants. After all, some of America's best-known restaurant chains were born in the Golden State, with entire business empires built on burgers and hot dogs, tacos and ice cream sundaes, and of course, service with a smile. And the chain's advertising campaigns became part of the soundtrack of growing up.
We have a great breakfast at the International House of Pancakes restaurant.
I'll have the Rudy Tooty.
The Rudy Tooty fresh and fruity breakfast.
Hamburgers and hot dogs all together now.
The story of the state's restaurant history is chronicled in the new book, Made in California, the California-born burger joints, diners, fast food, and restaurants that changed America by George Geary. And Mr. Geary joins us now. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well. So why did you want to chronicle well over a half century of California restaurant history in this book? What made you want to do it?
Well, I am a guy that loves history and food history, and then you add the buildings. Are the buildings still there? And that's what really started it. I saw the first Wiener Schnitzel, or Der Wiener Schnitzel is what they called it back there, when I drove by it in Wilmington one day, and I saw a plaque on this building, and I thought, well, that doesn't look like a Wiener Schnitzel. And then I read the plaque and it said this was our first location. And I started researching more and more places because I knew the McDonald's first location is now a museum that somebody else owns. The McDonald's company doesn't have anything to do with it. And I started making this list of all of these places that started here. And then while I was thinking of them, I thought, well, there's some places that aren't even there anymore, like the Copper Penny, if you remember that chain. And I thought, I wonder what happened to them. And so I just started researching, and then I put the book together. So that's kind of how it started.
Hmm. And you tell the story of so many restaurant chains. Let's start with kind of traditional fast food and hamburgers. I mean, a lot of us, even if we're not steeped in food history, know a bit about the beginning of McDonald's out in San Bernardino. Some of us might know about Carl's Jr. But you also focus on Fatburger, which is so associated with Los Angeles. It opened in 1947. Its original location was on Western Avenue. It was started by a woman named Lovey Yancey. Tell me about her and the restaurant chain she created.
Well, she created with her boyfriend it was called Mr. Fatburger to start with. And he allegedly had leftover lumber from work jobs, and he built this little tiny shack for her that only less than a dozen people could fit into it. And she'd make these burgers. And it was close to South Central LA. So it was in, at the time, you could say the rough part of town in the 40s. And nobody else would go down there. And she didn't have any restaurants to pull from. So she started making these great hamburgers. And her second location was in Beverly Hills because all of the stars were coming all the way down to see her. So she thought, I'm going to build the, in fact, that building's still there in Beverly Hills. It's not a Fatburger anymore.
Oh. And she was a black woman in this business, right? When it was pretty much just
rare.
A white guy's world.
Yeah. Yeah, because not very far, you could see that there was another burger stand that wasn't too far away that everybody from USC would go to. So she was pulling in a different audience, and she was catering to that audience. And then it did go national, and in fact, it's international because it's in 16 countries now.
All right, let's talk about a more upscale place, and that's Lawry's, the prime rib. What makes it stand out in California restaurant history?
The family. I mean, the very first Vandekamps, it's part of the Vandekamp family, or it was at the time, and the Frank family. There's still, I believe they're about sixth generation now. The one Frank family person that's in charge of the archives, and they've had so many different high-end type restaurants, steakhouses around California and the world, because Lawry's Prime Rib is in six countries. And they've only got 10 locations. They're very particular. And it's like no other place that you'll eating a prime rib at Lowry's. You can have prime rib any place, but it's the show also that they put on. And it was part of the original Restaurant Row on La Cienega in Los Angeles. And they've moved a couple times back and forth across the street from their original location to a different location that has another restaurant in it now. And then they moved back later on to the original address. I like a restaurant when you go in there, if it's a higher end sit down restaurant, that the waiters and the wait staff are professional wait staff and not actors. Or trying to be an actor in Hollywood. So that's the difference. You're going to see the same person wait on you.
And you talked about the show at Lowry's, and key to that was their cart they invented to roll meat around in the restaurant.
Yeah, it's it's the size of, I mean, it's like a small car, and the carver rolls those things around. In fact, the flooring had to be reinforced, and they always have to be reinforced wherever they open up one of the Lowry's. And they have these huge carts that are kind of very deco looking with silver, and they house about four racks of the prime rib, all the sides, and the hot plates. And it's just a fascinating show where you get fed right away. You know, the waiter, waitress comes over and they will serve you up, and the carver has to go through a lot of their training to be able to carve the roast beef. It's just, I'm getting hungry thinking about it. And that's what happened when I was writing the book. Every single chapter, when I would work on it, I'd want to go to that location, even if it was a hot dog stand. I'm like, I'm getting kind of hungry for these chili dogs. You know, you just start doing that. So,
you know, why do you think we have so much of our personal history wrapped up in these chains? I mean, as a kid, my mom's a special treat would take me to IHOP. And to this day, I remember the different syrups on the table of IHOP. And it's so clear and vivid in my mind. And I'm sure other people have other memories about other places. Why do you think we have that intersection between memory and food?
Because it's comforting. And it's the same thing with when you go to people say, oh, I ate there and I had the best meal. And then somebody else goes and you didn't have a good meal. It's the memories more than anything of who you were with when you ate there. Like you said, your mom would take you for something good. You know, you made good grades or something and you got to go to IHOP. It was a special thing. I think today places like IHOP, some people go every single Saturday no matter what, or they go every Friday night to the burger joint because mom doesn't want to cook. But back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, it was a special reason to go to those things. Plus, those places weren't on every street corner. And a lot of places did not start out thinking they were going to become chains. That was another thing that I thought was fascinating. They just had one or two little locations, and then they started getting bigger and bigger. It was rare that the family that started the places would keep the chain going. That's where it's very fascinating to me that In-N-Out has been able to do this.
All right, that is George Geary. He's the author of the new book, Made in California, the California-born burger joints, diners, fast food, and restaurants that changed America. George, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
And finally, on Greater LA Today, we're going to stay on the topic of food, but turn to the cuisine of the Jewish holiday table, as some important holidays are coming up. First, Rosh Hashanah, the celebration of the Jewish New Year. As of Monday, we'll be entering the year 5782, according to the Hebrew calendar. The week after that is Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and then Sukkot. Of course, like many religious holidays and days of observance and reflection, there are some particular foods associated with the coming days. Julie Jafrida writes about food for the LA Times, and she's here to tell us more about them. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
Okay, let's start with Rosh Hashanah. It's on Monday, as I said. What are the foods most associated with the Jewish New Year?
Well, I think what most people are accustomed to associating with the Jewish New Year are apples and honey. That's probably,
check,
you know, the quintessential, you know, sweet New Year. And then there's a whole tradition also of a Rosh Hashanah Seder, where there are a bunch of different vegetables that are used to symbolize wishes for the coming year. For example, leeks. And the reason that these particular foods were chosen is because they're puns with the Hebrew wish that it's for. So, for example, a leek is, koret is the name of leek in Hebrew, and the word that it sounds like is to cut down. So we say a blessing, may our enemies be cut down before us, or may our enemies be decimated. Dates are another food. The Hebrew word is tamar, and yitam, to end, is the word that it plays on. So we say, you know, may our enemies be ended. Or a beet is, selek is the name for beet, and the selek is preferred to be removed. So we say a wish for our adversaries to be removed.
And what about one kind of food, and that's bread, and that's challah in particular. That seems to have just grown in popularity in recent years. What makes it stand out? What's its story?
Well, challah, what challah really is not so much the braided bread we see before us, but technically the challah is the piece of the dough that's taken off of the bread when it's being made and thrown into the fire as a sacrifice. That's sort of where it came from.
Oh.
And then we eat the rest of the bread. As long as you've taken that little morsel off to throw it as a sacrifice, then your bread is challah. And typically it's eaten in a braid or some ornamental configuration. At Rosh Hashanah, we have a round challah to symbolize the circularity of the year.
So you don't have a loaf, kind of the traditional challah loaf.
Not a long loaf, a round loaf.
Huh. And what about another holiday, Yom Kippur? Of course, that is a that is a particularly reflective day of fasting and reflection. What are the foods most associated with that?
You know, that's usually a very light meal taken before the fast. A soup, you know, with some meat in it, and you know, something to sort of sustain you. And then some people end the fast with a date or just a small piece of bread. And then, of course, there are the big feasts and parties that we see people having all over the place to celebrate the end of the fast. And then the foods eaten are, you know, just sort of your classic foods of whatever culture the people who are celebrating are from or living in. Because, you know, Jewish food has really evolved as a result of the diaspora and the dispersion throughout the world, and different communities take on the cuisine of whatever country they're living in.
And finally, Sukkot. I am most associated that holiday with the structure that's often built. I believe some Jews will stay several days in the structure, but food is also part of that as well. So what kind of meals are we looking at there?
Well, someone who has built a sukkah in their yard or for the purpose of the holiday will often sleep in it throughout the week, but they'll also take all of their meals in the sukkah. And it's a tradition to invite guests. And so people invite living guests and sometimes also spiritually, you know, guests of the past, people we would have liked to talk to and bring in their ideas and use teachings to study. And the foods are, you know, basically Rosh Hashanah foods. And then a lot of people often like to include foods that are from the seven species of Israel. You know, these are the native foods to Israel: pomegranates, olives, grapes, dates, wheat, barley, and figs. So,
and yourself, Julie, what do you look most forward to eating in the coming 4 to 6 to 8 weeks or so during the holidays?
Oh, boy. Well, I love pomegranates, so I'm very happy to eat anything with pomegranates in it. And believe it or not, you know, I write about food and I work with food, but when it comes to holidays and getting together with people, on the one hand, I like to know there are certain foods on the table, but I'm really kind of more busy engaging with the people who I'm with.
So for you, it's all about the people first and the food second.
Don't tell anyone, though.
I won't. All right. That is Julie Giuffrida, who writes about food for the Los Angeles Times. Julie, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And that is Greater LA for today. I learned so much. Next week, LA Times columnist Erica Smith is hosting. You'll hear about a local company that's training formerly incarcerated people to fight wildfires all over the state. And one of the largest murals in the world, more than a mile long, is in the San Fernando Valley. Now there are plans to make it even longer. As always, our show is available at kcrw.com/greaterLA. You can listen to it anytime you go there. You can also subscribe to the podcast. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Sue Margulies, Amy Ta, Christine Comito, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all make this show happen, and they're great people. I'm Saul Gonzalez. You can hear me early weekday mornings on KCRW on the California Report. This is Greater LA. Thanks so much for listening.